Hello, and welcome to the second edition of Cromford's Assortment on Thursday, the 2nd of April, 2020. On this day, the 2nd of April, 1935, Robert Watson Watt was granted a patent for his invention of radar. So if you ever use the expression, so-and-so is not on my radar, Robert Watson Watt is the man you can thank. On this day in 1968, 2001 A Space Odyssey had its movie premiere at the Uptown Theatre in Washington.
Divide by zero, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave, but I'm afraid I can't do that.
On this day in 1979, a Soviet military research lab near Sverdlovsk in Russia accidentally, the emphasis is mine, accidentally released anthrax spores into the air. There were possibly as few as 60 deaths, possibly as many as 100. No one knows for sure to this day. The authorities attributed the cause of the anthrax outbreak to the consumption and handling of contaminated meat. It wasn't until 1992 that a military research lab was identified as the real cause. Strokes chin. On this day in 1982, the Falkland Islands were invaded by Argentine military forces, triggering the Falklands War, or as it was euphemistically called at the time, the Falklands Conflict. On this day in 2005, Pope John Paul II popped his papal clogs after 27 years of hogging the best bedroom in the Vatican. On this day in 1836, Charles Dickens married Catherine Hogarth. It's tempting to make a joke about that based on a title from a Dickens book, but I'm not going to. On this day in 1914, the actor Alec Guinness was born. On this day in 1805, Hans Christian Andersen was born, and International Children's Book Day is always celebrated on or around this day. Also, today is World Autism Awareness Day, and if ever there was a time to be mindful of how those of us on the autism spectrum are coping with day-to-day life, the coronavirus emergency is one of those times, and today is surely one of those days. Okay, I'm going to play you a song from my archives now, but I didn't write it. Back in 2013, I was one of a small group of people who entered the Festival Fringe in Buxton, in Derbyshire, and we were presenting a show recreating the first Crosby, Stills and Nash album. Anyone that knows that first Crosby, Stills and Nash album will know that the singing is pretty intricate, so I had to put some demos together for all of us to learn the parts, so that when we put all the parts together, hopefully, we'd sound pretty much like the album. So this is one of the demos that I made back in 2013 for that. It's the song Guinevere, and I have quickly spruced it up for the benefit of this programme. You'll hear Cromford, Cromford and Cromford acting as Crosby, Stills and Nash on vocals, with Cromford and a side order of more Cromford on guitars. This is my demo of Guinevere.
Yours, my lady, like yours. walk down through the garden in the morning after it rained. Peacocks wandered aimlessly underneath an orange tree. Why can't she see me?
Moving right along, now we'll have a bit of daftness. Yeah, ever since I saw Grief Rhys Jones do those Holston Pills TV commercials in the 1980s, you know the ones where he plonked himself into the middle of a classic black and white film, seeming to interact with all the actors, I've always fancied doing something similar. And now I've finally got the chance. Here I am, playing Philip Marlowe in a scene from the Howard Hawks 1946 classic The Big Sleep. Apologies in advance for yet another atrocious attempt at an American accent by yours truly. But here I present The Big Slurp.
Marlowe, General.
Hello.
Sit down. Brandy, Norris. How do you like your brandy, sir?
in a long Tupperware beaker with a straw.
Why?
I find the straw helps me concentrate.
I used to like mine with champagne. Champagne cold as Valley Forge and with about 3 ponies of brandy under it. Oh, come, man. Pour a decent one. I like to see people drink. Tell me about yourself, Mr. Morrow.
There's not much to tell. I'm 38 and I went to college. I've worked as a gantry crane driver's mate, still got the bucket and the disinfectant, and as a body double in martial arts movies. These days I'll do just about anything for money. Oh, by the way, your butler's getting his shoes wet.
That'll do, Norris. You may take off your coats, huh?
Thanks. I'm gonna have to take my trousers off, too. My combinations are sweaty.
Go on, sir. Too hot in here for any man who has any blood in his veins. You may smoke, too.
Oh, that's not smoke, General. I'm steaming.
What does that mean?
Means you'll need to get this chair recovered when I've gone.
I can still enjoy the smell of it.
General, why don't you tell me what your problem is while I drink my brandy?
I'm being blackmailed again. About a year ago, I paid a man named Joe Brody $5,000 to let my younger daughter alone.
Is this the same Joe Brody who calls himself the Prawn Cracker King? Stands on the sidewalks with free samples, shouting to people, I'm crackers, have a prawn?
Yes.
Did you ask your daughter whether she's addicted to these things?
No, and I don't intend to. If I did, she'd just suck her thumb and look coy. Carmen is still the little child who likes to pull the wings off flies.
So I guess the only thing that'll keep Carmen off the prawn crackers is a collection of dead flies.
Yes. Nasty things.
And you want to employ me as Carmen's fly catcher?
Yes.
Well, I'd better go and get swatting. Thanks for the brandy, General.
I enjoyed your drink as much as you did, sir. Good luck.
Hell, I'd better go back to collect my trousers.
Now I'd like to introduce a new spot for these programmes, something I'm calling On the Trot. I'm going to dig out an old, fairly lively piece of music that you can stick into your earbuds if you're going out for your daily jog or just using your treadmill at home or skipping on the spot or whatever it is. I want to kick off this spot with a brilliantly cool, classy piece of music from the early 1960s. It's Nelson Riddle's title music from the American TV series Route 66. And when you put this on and start moving to it, you're no longer jogging past the backs of the charity shops and the dustbins. No, you're cruising in your V8 Ford along that long, straight blacktop through New Mexico, heading into Arizona. Route 66. We'll be right back.
And now it's time for a boo at bedtime. To recap from last week, the narrator is renting the basement and the back garden of a large converted house. His only neighbour, Robert C. Hogg, is a small, obsessive man who lives at the top of the house. Following an unsettling experience in the back garden one evening, the narrator is visited the next night by his neighbour, complaining of a blown fuse. A Vindictive Woman by R. Chetwynd Hayes. Part 2. A strip light on the top landing enabled me to see the open door of his flat and part of the tiny kitchen beyond. But I was completely unprepared for the unpleasant smell that seemed to be waiting to pounce the moment I set foot over the threshold. It had a sweetish, cloying quality that can only be associated with a rotting corpse. And it was so intense that I only just managed to suppress a snort of disgust. I turned on the torch and was relieved to see that the main switch and its attendant fuse box were just by the door. I lost no time in removing the cover, pulling out the china fuse and replacing the burnt strip of wire. The entire operation took no more than 2 minutes, but to me, knowing that a still, silent figure was watching from the shadows, it seemed as if my fumbling fingers would never complete the job. Then I pushed the fuse home and instantly a 25-watt bulb that dangled from the ceiling sprang into dingy life. I got up, brushed my trouser legs, and gradually became aware of a bone-numbing coldness that had, so to speak, been demanding recognition for some time. It seemed to grow more intense by the second, and I heard my voice, loud, shrill, with something akin to fear, demand, "Good God, man, haven't you lit a fire?" He remained unmoving, silent, and I, motivated by irritation and alarm, and perhaps some slight curiosity, walked into the small bed-sitting room and looked around with incredulous eyes. An extremely ancient gas fire spluttered angrily from behind a cracked tiled hearth, but for all the heat it sent out, a solitary candle might have been more effective. However, it was the almost terrifying cleanness of the place which attracted my full attention. He had scrubbed the bare floorboards snow white, a result that can only be achieved by using boiling water well dosed with soda, a potent mixture that can be very tough on the fingernails, as my early days in the army had taught me. The narrow bed, which lurked against one wall, had been stripped, and the blankets, sheets were conspicuous by their absence, folded into neat squares and placed one on top of the other. He had even taken the trouble to clean the gas tap so that it gleamed like a fragment of burnished gold. Walls and ceiling were covered with a thick coating of whitewash that, when supplemented by a naked electric light bulb, dazzled the eye and created the illusion that the room had been carved out of snow. I detected no concession to comfort. One plain wooden chair crouched in front of the ineffective fire and gave the impression that it would freeze the backside of anyone who was so foolhardy as to sit on it. The only other item of furniture was a plain deal table with a surface that might have been even more well scrubbed than the floor. I managed to laugh and say, "You certainly keep the place neat." He gave me a strange, part anxious, part sly look.
"There are no stains?"
"None that I can see."
"But how can you stand the cold? It's enough to freeze the what's-its off the proverbial."
He looked round at his chilly domain and sighed deeply.
"Cold preserves, but there is still the corruption of the soul."
I shivered and edged towards the door. "That's too profound for me.
How about a cup of tea? I could most certainly do with one. He hesitated and, for a moment, appeared to be on the point of refusing, then slowly nodded.
That is very kind of you. Yes, I'd like to very much.
When we reached my flat, I motioned him to an armchair and went into the kitchen, where I brewed a large pot of tea, deciding the poor wretch needed well thawing out before again ascending to that icebox. Determined to demonstrate how civilized people live, I placed teapot, cups and saucers, spoons, sugar basin and slop bowl onto a rather grand trolley I had just acquired and wheeled it into my sitting room. I found him seated well forward on the chair, hands outstretched, while he gazed almost reproachfully at my elaborate gas fire. He looked up as I entered and produced a rare smile.
You really shouldn't have gone to all this trouble. Extraordinarily kind of you.
Not at all, I replied, moving a low table beside his chair. I have a cup myself at this time. You take sugar? He shook his head violently.
Oh dear, no, that would never do. She would not...
He stopped short, and my, perhaps unfortunate, lust for knowledge received a little fillip of encouragement. So, there was a woman in the background. It was only to be expected, although I had rather imagined him to be a confirmed bachelor. Biscuits? I inquired. I have some passable digestives. One might have assumed I had just invited him to accept the United Crowns of Great Britain.
Really, that would be too much.
Nonsense, I replied, and went to fetch the tin. We sat and drank tea and nibbled a vast amount of biscuits, at least he did, while I tried to light a fire of informative conversation. I've often thought that those urbane interviewers on television would soon be out of a job if all of their questions were answered by a plain yes or no. Mr. Hogg almost proved my point. I assume, I murmured, with what I could only hope was an air of polite interest, you are not married? Mr. Hogg waited until he had masticated a biscuit before replying.
Not now.
But you have been.
Yes.
The affirmative could be considered a tiny step forward along the path of inquiry. The fellow was either a widower or divorced. I decided to assume the former. I'm sorry. You must be very lonely.
Yes.
It was then that he, with a rather ironic smile, posed his own question.
And you, Mr...
Glynn, I replied, feeling as if I was parting with a state secret. Henry Glynn.
And you, Mr. Glynn, you two are alone?
I shrugged. I've had several trial runs, but have yet to discover a woman who does not bore me after 3 weeks. I'm willing to concede that this may be the result of a flaw in my character. He shook his head and emitted a quaint chuckle of amusement.
How indeed extraordinary to think that a woman can bore you. Imagine, Mr. Glynn, if the shoe was on the other foot. Suppose you bored them.
Not an impossibility, I replied dryly. I must have often been the subject of a feminine yawn. He began to display more animation than I would have thought possible, so much so that he upset his teacup. He was at once profusely apologetic.
How careless of me. Really unforgivable. If you will fetch a cloth, forget it,
I ordered brusquely, alarmed lest this mishap deprive me of much desired information. Tea is good for the carpet, you were about to say. He replaced the cup carefully on the side table, then wiped his hands on a spotless handkerchief. He spoke slowly, as though savouring each word.
Suppose, Mr. Glynn, you fell hopelessly in love with a woman much younger than yourself, and experienced a kind of unsurpassable delight when she agreed to marry you. Then, having given her your all, house, not insignificant savings, devotion, self-respect. Suppose one day she yawns in your face and orders you out of the house. What would you do, Mr. Glynn?
Reach for the nearest hairbrush, I replied, without hesitation. It was then that he said something which at the time I assumed to be a joke.
Not a poker, Mr. Glynn?
I shook my head. No, no. The use of a poker could turn out to be more than corrective. It might even be fatal. Another cup of tea, Mr. Hogg?
You are indeed very kind.
He waited until I had refilled his cup before continuing.
I sometimes have a fanciful notion that life is a narrow plank that stretches from the cradle to the grave, and if God is kind to us, we cross without serious mishap. But one false step, one moment of inattention, and we spend eternity in a black pit of despair.
He looked up.
Would you say women are vindictive, Mr. Glynn?
Some, I replied, warily. I've met one or two. He took a dainty sip from his cup and gazed thoughtfully into the fire. A full 2 minutes passed before he spoke again.
Believe me, a really vindictive woman has much in common with a hungry tiger. She will stalk you to perdition, and no amount of penance will placate her.
His voice sank to a thrilling whisper, and despite the warm room, I shivered.
At first, she keeps her distance, and the victim is only permitted to see her a long way off, at the end of a railway platform, on a bridge looking down, at the bottom of a garden. Then she moves in for the kill.
He lapsed into silence, and for the first time I became really alarmed and wished the hell I had never let him into the flat. The memory of that shape under the trees was still fresh. At last I was able to marshal words into a number one question. And are you? You, Mr. Hogg? Pursued by such a woman? This time, he dropped the cup and was much too agitated to apologise. I thought for a moment he was going to be sick over my best carpet. And then speech came tumbling over lax lips.
Why do you ask? Have you seen her?
I spoke slowly while watching him through narrowed eyes. Last night, I thought I saw someone under the trees. And that was it. He got up, his face a mask of pure terror, and all but ran for the door, and left me as near dumbfounded as at any time in my life. But he must have slowed down on reaching the hall, for I heard him creeping up the second flight of stairs, as though reluctant to reach the top landing. And you can hear the final part of A Vindictive Woman in next week's programme. And I've run out of time for this programme. Make a date for the next one on Thursday, the 9th of April. In the meantime, keep a grip on yourself. Be patient, stay sane, safe, and well. I made this program for you, and I'm going to be here sending them out as long as you're there to receive them. Let's get through this. Bye for now. Paul Cromford's assortment was conceived, assembled and presented by me, Paul Cromford. I don't own the David Crosby song Guinevere, the Warner Brothers movie The Big Sleep, or Nelson Riddle's TV theme Route 66. I just borrowed them to entertain you. A Vindictive Woman was written by R. Chetwynd Hayes, edited for broadcast by Paul Cromford. Eerie Ambiences for a Boo at Bedtime, courtesy of Just No Copyright Music, Carol Morden Todd, ESN Productions, and Paul Cromford. This was a Paul Cromford production for you.